Good Tuesday afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large for May 18th, 2021 on your public radio station 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for being with us. Ahead this hour, there have been discussions, conversations, and arguments about Confederate monuments across the country for years, including the Confederate soldier in the middle of the Bentonville Square. In her new book, No Common Ground, Karen L. Cox follows the history of the statues throughout the nation and the legacy of white supremacy that has been behind them. Our conversation with Karen L. Cox in our second half hour today. After Ozarks at Large on Here and Now, rock duo The Black Keys pays tribute to the Delta Blues that inspired them on their new album. Plus, the latest on the escalating conflict in the Gaza Strip. Here and Now begins at 1 this afternoon. Tonight at 7, KUAF brings you live music from the stage at Walton Arts Center as the Dover Quartet performs as part of the Artisphere Festival. Leah Uribe and Lee Wood will host the live music tonight. And in about 15 minutes on Ozarks, a conversation between Lee and Leah and the Dover Quartet, recorded via Zoom before the musicians arrived in Fayetteville for tonight's concert. The Arkansas Department of Transportation is firing a bridge inspector who failed to notice damage on at least two separate occasions on a now-closed bridge over the Mississippi River. Department officials say they terminated the inspector yesterday over his failure to notice damage to the Interstate 40 Mississippi River Bridge in September 2019 and September 2020. RDOT Director Lori Tudor says the department has contacted the FBI to determine whether criminal charges should be filed.
Our investigation not only revealed the negligence of an employee, it also revealed a process failure that is the responsibility of RDOT. We should have discovered this crack in the beam in 2019, and we are taking steps to hold those responsible for not doing their jobs accountable, but more importantly, to correct the flaws in our process.
The employee, whose name has not been released, allegedly did not perform a hands-on, inch-by-inch inspection of the 48-year-old bridge and did not notice a crack in one of the bridge's load-bearing beams. A team of contractors found the crack last week, forcing the closure of the bridge. Tudor says the department has begun an internal investigation into supervisors and other members of the former inspector's team.
Still have an investigation. It's ongoing. But we're not stopping right here at this employee. We're making sure it's not any kind of systemic or there's some other negligence involved.
Tudor says the department will conduct a reinspection of every fractured critical bridge that was inspected by the former employee. Polls in Arkansas remain open until 7:30 tonight for school elections. Several area districts are conducting elections for school board members and millage issues. The race for the Republican nomination for lieutenant governor continues to grow. Washington County Judge Joseph Wood is the fourth candidate to announce his candidacy for the nomination. He joins Doyle Webb, the former head of the state GOP, Arkansas's Surgeon General Greg Bledsoe, and State Senator Jason Rapert in the race. Primary elections in Arkansas are in a little more than a year. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting an increase of 15 patients hospitalized from COVID-19 in the last 24 hours. But active cases in the state dropped below 2,000 for the first time in 2 weeks. The Monday report includes 67 new cases of the virus. That's the lowest new case total since May 3rd. Two more deaths from the virus were reported. 5,796 Arkansans have died from COVID-19. A Northwest Health vaccine clinic scheduled for today in Fayetteville, by the way, has been canceled. The Arkansas men's golf team, ranked 24th in the nation, is in sixth place after the first of 3 days of an NCAA regional near Nashville. The top five teams from that 13-team field will advance to the NCAA championships. There is a 70% chance of rain, possibly a thunderstorm tonight with lows in the mid-60s, a 90% chance of rain tomorrow with highs from 75 to 80. Thank you. A pleasant Tuesday afternoon to you. Thanks for being with us. This is Ozarks at Large. A Woodland family farm in West Elkin sells commercial organically grown produce and container garden starts by subscription and donates a good portion to families in need. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to Good to Grow Farm to bring us their story.
Good to Grow is a cooperative farm located on a lush woodland western-facing slope in rural Elkins. The 53-acre parcel, which contains a deep well, spring-fed pond, and intermittent creek, was slated for commercial development. But two women, Ashley Hicks and sister-in-law Jennifer Hicks, saved the historic family homestead.
I'm Ashley Hicks, and my husband and I purchased this property about 2 weeks before the pandemic hit. Jennifer is my husband's sister, my business partner, but I really feel like she and I are sisters. I'm a registered nurse, and she works in nursing education, so we're cut from the same cloth. We're both really highly empathetic people, and we would come out to this garden, and the only way that I know how to say it is we would grieve for humanity.
The women discovered tending their shared family garden plot last spring and summer and fall to be a great comfort as the pandemic worsened.
And at that point in the pandemic, we would discuss ideas. We both knew we wanted to do something to help, but didn't really know what. I taught my kids to sew masks for my nurse colleagues, wrote letters advocating for a safe return for teachers, and showed up to in-person protests. She made care packages for nurses and had lunch catered to hospitals.
But that charity work wasn't enough. Ashley had enrolled in grad school to pursue a master's degree in nursing. That's when she discovered pervasive poverty in Northwest Arkansas doing academic research.
I started digging into actual data on this problem. Pre-pandemic, Arkansas ranked the third highest in food insecurity at about 13% of the population experiencing this. We all know that these problems got worse with the economic shutdown.
So the sisters-in-law resolved to do something.
We're aware that we have this amazing resource that not a lot of people have, land. Let's feed Fayetteville with it. We're not agriculturalists. We're not master gardeners. We have heart, dedication, and want to share our abundance with the community. Last year, when we grew the pandemic garden for ourselves, we had so much food. I literally drove around Fayetteville, leaving it on porches, and stocked the little free pantries with preserved garden goodies well into December. We're both really hard workers, and I know that we can do this.
This being Good to Grow, a family-operated commercial farming venture selling subscription produce, but asking subscribers, if able, to purchase an additional subscription for a family in need. In its first year, the farm produced a surplus of fresh tomatoes, cucumbers, corn, beans, squash, herbs, and more. The women employing self-taught regenerative agriculture techniques.
The main principle of regenerative agriculture is to feed the soil and to really build your soil up. When we first purchased this property, this garden area was about shoulder high in weeds, and there was just a thick mat of Bermuda. So my husband did come and burn everything, and we did till the first year just to have some workable soil. We couldn't even get to the soil. But from there on out, we practiced no-till. We did have the cows on the property, so we would go around and scoop up their manure and bring it to the garden. All of this black plastic that's out here right now is to solarize the soil, warm it up, kill the weeds, and it's also cooking that manure underneath it right now.
Ashley Hicks, a former ICU and hospice nurse, and most recently a public school nurse, had never farmed before. But she discovered a kindred spirit in her sister-in-law, now business partner Jennifer Hicks, a nurse educator who's working to fill a critical nursing shortage in Arkansas.
I grew up being forced to garden. I thought I was mistreated when my parents made me work in the garden. So I forgot how to do all of that until I was probably 45. And then, like everything else that I do, oddly, I learned everything that needed to be done.
With the help of extended family, the large garden plots are now well established. This season expected to provide as many as 30 weekly shares of produce by subscription, also known as community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, which they hope patrons will match for families in need. But there's more.
One of the things that Ashley really had on her heart was to help people in public housing and food insecure areas to create community gardens. But we learned that many of the public housing communities don't allow public utilities to be used for community gardens. And Ashley and I were immediately thinking we need to do something to help. And so the garden in the box concept was formed. So we looked for all seeds that could be grown in containers, and we came up with about 10 container appropriate vegetables and produce items that could be grown, you know, indoors or on patios in the public housing communities. And so now we're offering buy one, donate one gardens in a box to our community members.
This winter, the women started over 6,000 seedlings for their gardens in a box venture inside their kitchens, some porches, back porches, and the farm greenhouse. The portable boxed gardens will be distributed later this month to customers as well as to families at no cost living in low-income housing developments. Ashley Hicks says the gardens in a box are perfect for families living in such places who are legally barred from planting gardens on their public facilities land.
And that was the whole reason that we specifically designed our garden in a box to contain plants that can be grown on a countertop or below a sunny window. And we've invested in these containers with handles that can easily be carried in and out.
After the gardens in a box are delivered and the early summer garden is in full production, the women will deliver weekly organic CSA shares or vegetable subscriptions to families who sign up.
And we're also going to carry over that same buy one, donate one concept, where for every person who buys a what we call BODO garden share, we are also going to donate a weekly box to Fayetteville Public Schools Outback.
Outback is the name of Fayetteville Public School District's food pantry. Public school social workers, Ashley Hicks says, will select families to receive free produce from the Hicks family farm. Good to Grow has also cultivated community partners to help, including Seeds at Feed and St. James Missionary Baptist Church Food Pantry, which is currently alerting families about the gardens in a box being available. Jennifer Hicks says 50 families have signed up so far.
Brightwater Culinary School is providing culturally appropriate recipes and cooking lessons for our Marshallese communities and our Latinx communities. And the garden, Botanic Garden of the Ozarks, will also be providing growing education for those families who have never grown fresh vegetables. So we're working with many different organizations to feed at least 100 families through the gardens in a box.
Those interested in purchasing gardens in a box, as well as weekly organic produce with the option of BODO, buy one, donate one, are required to register.
People can go to our website, which is goodtogrow.org, and that's good, the number two, grow.org. And people have the option to register for 23 weeks of fresh produce to be delivered to their door. That would be to any family that wants a single share, a full share, or if they want to buy 23 weeks of fresh produce for delivery and donate 23 weeks of fresh produce for delivery, they can also do that at the website. Or they can purchase a garden in a box, which again is 10 seedlings of container-appropriate vegetables and herbs for their family, or they can buy one and donate one to families who need resources for growing their own foods.
We've posted a slideshow of the Hicks Family Farm as well as Good to Grow farm contact information on our news web. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And still to come on this Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large, a conversation with Karen L. Cox about her book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. And just ahead, a conversation with the Dover Quartet. They'll be live on stage at the Walton Arts Center tonight as part of Artisphere. And that concert will be broadcast live beginning at 7 on 91.3 KUAF. The conversation, recorded via Zoom before they arrived in Northwest Arkansas, just ahead. And you can find classical music at any time on KUAF, too. It's our 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week digital station devoted solely to classical music. You can listen at KUAF.com. You can also find it for free on your HD radio, either at home or in your car. And you can always ask your smart speaker to please play KUAF 2. And if you're in the mood for jazz, KUAF 3 has you covered. That, too, available on your HD radio at KUAF.com or, again, by asking your smart speaker to please play KUAF 3.
Join KUAF for a special night of live chamber music from the Dover Quartet. Tonight, beginning at 7 p.m., here for their 10th appearance as the resident ensemble for the Artisphere Festival Orchestra. The world-renowned quartet will perform pieces by Dvorak, Mendelssohn, and Arkansas composer William Grant Still. The concert hall comes to you with the Dover Quartet, this evening at 7 p.m. on 91.3.
Before the Dover Quartet arrived here for tonight's concert, they sat down via Zoom with Leah Uribe and Lee Wood to discuss their careers, their history with the Artisphere Festival, and their efforts to make classical music available to a wider audience, something that's been their passion for years. The Dover Quartet is Milana Parovendastat, viola, Joel Link, violin, Brian Lee, violin, and Camden Shaw, cello. Their conversation also touched on how musicians have spent the pandemic exploring music further and how the world of performance is returning in a different world following the murder of George Floyd. The members of the Dover Quartet are proponents of playing music of composers' work that is underperformed on world stages, including composers of the past and the present. The music of one of those composers, native Arkansan William Grant Still, is included in tonight's program.
Well, I don't know about you guys. I think I might have heard of his music, maybe the earliest. My dad is Colombian, actually, and I had the opportunity to compete in the Sphinx competition. And if you don't know about the Sphinx organization, it's incredible, giving opportunities to Latinx and Black musicians. And when I went to the competition, William Grant Still, Mother and Child for violin and piano, was one of the required pieces, and absolutely gorgeous. So since then, I think I was about 12 or 13 years old when I first started playing his music. It's so beautiful, so sweet, so heartfelt. And I'm surprised that not more people play his music more regularly. Absolutely. When we wanted to start doing what we could for equality and inclusion in music, that was one of the first names that came to my mind.
So Tuesday's performance is going to be one of the first performances back at the Walton Arts Center. And so we're getting a sense of normalcy, but as Leah said, we're kind of emerging back into a different world than it was 14 months ago. And being so world-renowned, but also being so young, do you guys feel a sense of leadership or responsibility to sort of bring classical music into this new world we're emerging into?
I mean, I think, speaking for myself only, I don't really think so much about us being young or renowned or sort of categorically in any sense, but I do think that we feel a responsibility to be part of, you know, a progressive positive change, regardless of those categories. And I think also it's been nice to see that in many different spheres where we're involved, at the Curtis Institute, for instance, in Philadelphia, there is a lot of discussion in every sphere about that. And that's really heartening to see that it's there are a lot of good people working on these issues in a lot of different arenas. And that's it's inspiring. And of course, there's always more that can be done and probably better ways that it can be done as well. And there's a responsibility to try to make that inclusion happen in the most positive way. And we've had discussions about that because that can be difficult. For instance, deciding how much to to give voice to composers of the past who have not been played enough, like William Grant Still, and then balancing that with wanting to support new voices as well. And because there is, at the end of the day, a limited amount of time that any artist has. And so there are many more discussions to be had.
That is so beautiful, and thank you for bringing that. And I wonder also, what are you doing in the realm of approaching new audiences, which is part of this work as well? It's not only changing repertoire and the pieces, you know, per se, but where do you go to play? Who do you want to play for?
Well, I guess I'll jump on this one. This year, strangely, we've been able to reach more different audiences because of the sudden like immersion in the virtual world. And the audiences, one of the reasons we made the documentary in the first place was to be able to do that. It was to be able to kind of break the barriers and the walls that make us feel like our field is such a separate and kind of niche thing from the rest of humanity somehow. So this has been important to us for a long time, but we've had better opportunities now. In the past, when we've been touring and playing in different cities, different universities, we generally will end up, if there's an opportunity to go play for, a school full of underprivileged or kids or going to the shelter here in Philadelphia, we've done things like that. And it's just amazing to be able to introduce people to music they have never heard before, instruments they've never seen before, and connect on a human level where instantly someone hears the music and of course it makes sense to them because we're all human and we're all listening to the emotions in a very similar way.
I'm so glad to hear you say that about the film, because I loved in the film the intimacy that you shared about your lives and that it really did, I think, give people an insight into what your life is like as a working musician, instead of maybe this idea of classical music being on a pedestal or being untouchable. You gave such an intimate view of your lives. Was that one of the ideas you had going into making the film?
I might add that we're just as weird as everyone else.
Exactly. Just as weird as everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were one little detail before we made the film and before we got the idea to do it. We were quite young when we started touring. We were in our like early 20s, and we would be asked at airports, where we spend a lot of our time, are you guys a band? Or, you know, what do you guys do? And we said, yeah, well, so to speak, we're a string quartet. What kind of music? Classical. Really, you don't look like classical musicians. What does that mean? Just the fact that so many people have this preconceived notion of what do we look like? Should we have like white
powdered white wigs?
Wigs.
Have to be old and a little hopeless.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up because, again, in the film, I know, Melanie, you talk a little bit about being the only woman in the group and about dealing with the perception and people's sort of reactions to that. And I'm wondering if that happens to the entire group, like you said, about what identities you bring to the quartet and if there are things you have to go through in bringing that identity. People don't expect you, I guess, maybe to look like you would be in a band instead of in a string quartet.
Yeah. Well, as we keep discovering in so many ways, assumptions are just almost never constructive. Even when they're accurate sometimes. But assumptions, for instance, about, what a classical musician should look like, both in age or bringing it back to the George Floyd discussions about inclusion, imagining what race a classical musician should be, all those things, they're never that constructive. And I guess the truth is, a classical musician could be anyone. And that is something that we would like to show in the film as well. Of course, we're limited to the four of us, but there's a huge spectrum of identities and backgrounds that we do represent. And of course, that expands far beyond just a quartet.
I wanted to ask you guys, I know you're a very tight-knit group. You have a lot of history together. And I loved the film. I loved seeing that time go, how your relationships sort of change and morph and over time and how you still are so close. But if you could play with anyone, either individually or take the group with you to play with anyone, who would you like to play with?
Do they have to be alive?
No.
Or is it just like a dream sort of prospect?
This is fantasy. We'll play fantasy.
I know. I was thinking about Duke Ellington and Sarah Vaughan and those people, like going back to the really soulful, intimate jazz world.
That would be amazing.
It feels so weird to think about it. Like the cliche answer is I would probably still play with the people I do. I mean, I really do have a lot of respect for my colleagues. I know that's like the not answer, but.
It's a very
this is hard. Like my mind has never really gone there, like in a real way. So
I feel like I could say like any number of composers who were, you know, proficient at like a string instrument, Dvorak, for instance, his viola quintet with him would be sort of cool. Stuff like that, I think would be, pretty fun.
Camden, you have a,
I guess a couple. I mean, I would restrict it. I'll restrict it to living person because I think there are just too many for me, too many people of the past I could not ever choose. But one living person who I find so artistically fascinating is this guy. The quartet's not going to be surprised I'm saying this. Dave Longstreth is his name, who writes all the music for the Dirty Projectors, which is an indie group. But essentially, I mean, he was a Yale composer, a classical, classically trained composer. And essentially his music is really hard to define or to describe, but it's very adventurous and advanced. And I really love the way that he thinks. So I would be so curious to play with him, at some point, and maybe we can even make that happen. We'll see.
I was going to say, the power of commissioning and all of these interactions we can experience. You have been coming to Fayetteville for 10 years, right? You have been interacting with this community. How do you envision all of these changes, opening spaces, making, your music available in our community, Northwest Arkansas, that you already know and you have actually strong connections with? How do you envision that? And maybe even going a little bit further, what is your role in that change?
What we've been doing, when we go to Artist Fair every summer, that's been happening every single year. We feel more integrated into the community. We feel more close to everyone we encounter, and the community grows. My favorite night of every summer that we go to Fayetteville is the pop-up concerts when we go up and down Dixon Street and play in the cafes and the bars and restaurants. And you start to have people every year, the same people coming back, but then it grows and more people are coming. The audience is so much more diverse than if we were just to only play in the Walton Arts Center or at Crystal Bridges. And then it brings those people into the Walton Arts Center and to Crystal Bridges. And I remember meeting a family at one of the bars and then deciding that I would use a few of my complimentary tickets to bring them out to Crystal Bridges, where they'd never even seen the museum. So I think that they've been on a really good track, or we have been there. And if we can do more of that, going to the farmer's market, playing outside, the trail mix concerts, I think that just... And it goes with the whole theme of Artisphere too, which is music and nature. So I think it's just really, there's a reason it's one of our favorite places to be. It's doing the right thing. Like, we're already starting to do that connection, spread of connection.
I also, I think it's kind of, it's laced in everything that Milena's saying, but I feel like for me, I think our role is to not dumb down the music, but to, if you want to call it this, not dumbing down the concert hall, but like reinventing the concert hall experience for people, because I feel like there is all that stigma and like this feeling of like, oh, people are fancy and they know when to clap and like they know what to wear and all this stuff. And I think like people are often just really afraid of the experience because they feel like they're not going to be accepted or they can't enjoy it in the way that they would like to enjoy it. And that's what I think Artisphere has done so well is, even what Milena talking about going up and down Dixon Street, like the music stays the same. It's not like we're shortening it or like not playing it well. Like the idea is like, sure, maybe it's not the most rehearsed performance because people are sitting together reading, but that's what we would do with our friends normally as classical musicians on a fun evening, if that's, you know, the kind of chosen poison of the evening, right? Like to like sit around and read, and that's really fun. It doesn't always sound great, but the idea is that I think the focus is on doing something at a super high level, but also in a way that brings people in.
Yeah, so. Actually, that what Joel was saying, like reinventing the experience, reminds me of just this perception I think people have of needing to know something about the music before they can enjoy it or before they can hear it, which I, for whatever reason, I really think this art form is the one that's the most prevalent, that expectation. But we put all these, or I say we, but we're in it. People who don't really, haven't been immersed in classical music, put expectations on themselves or what they are supposed to do or react, how they're supposed to react, how they're even supposed to feel when they listen to the music, what they're supposed to understand. This kind of thing that we don't really do if we were to like, I haven't studied art or art history. And I could go to a museum and just be like, I wonder what that's going to feel like to look at it. And I don't put all this pressure on myself to know something or to feel a certain emotion when I look at the art. And I think that if we could treat music that way too, as just our own personal discovery, our own personal journey, that'll take all that pressure and stress off the experience.
The Dover Quartet, Milena Perrovandastot Viola, Joel Link Violin, Brian Lee Violin, and Camden Shaw Cello, talking with Leah Uribe and Lee Wood via Zoom last week. That's before the musicians arrived in Northwest Arkansas for tonight's concert at the Walton Arts Center as part of the annual Artisphere Festival. The concert will be broadcast live tonight on KUAF beginning at 7. It's hosted by Leah Uribe and Lee Wood. You can learn more about the Dover Quartet and the documentary discussed during that conversation at doverquartet.com. More about Walton Arts Center and the Artisphere Festival at waltonartcenter.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Chefs in the Garden at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks, now sold out. However, BGO invites everyone to terrific Tuesday nights, June through August. Tuesday evenings, the garden offers extended hours from 5 to 8 p.m., and admission is free. Family-friendly concerts will be offered on select dates. BGOzarks.org for more information. This is Ozarks at Large. Statues of Confederate figures are not a rarity throughout the South. Many were erected not long after the Confederacy lost the war. Many more put up decades after the end of the Civil War. And efforts to remove many from public spaces has intensified in recent years. We reported in September about the plans to move the Confederate soldier in the middle of the Bentonville Square to a park and away from the center of town. In her new book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice, Karen Cox traces the history of the monuments, the people who raised money to have them created, and the attempts to remove them. She says the words, No Common Ground, refer to the history of the monuments and the messages sent by the monuments.
From the time the first monuments go into public spaces, not so much the cemeteries, because that's where the first monuments went, but when they come out, you know, after Reconstruction and they start to emerge in the public square, then it isn't common ground anymore. It's a ground that is dominated. It's a white space, let's say, and it's dominated by that. And it's a symbol and a signal to people of color, African Americans, obviously, primarily in the South, of who's important in the community, who's in charge in the community, these sorts of things, who is worth remembering, some of these could have been slave owners. You know, they might have been veterans, but they also owned slaves.
The first wave of these monuments, and you mentioned there were some in cemeteries, but the first wave that started getting into the public square, in front of courthouses and in town squares, happens post-Reconstruction, late 19th century. So we have living veterans of the Confederacy, and these start going up, and it's sort of what we would call now a flex. Like, this is to show you who's still in power.
It really is. It's the boom period, I would call it, of monument building was between 1890 and 1920. Women were, you know, the driving force behind that. But what's also happening in the same era, that same 1890 to 1920 period, is the is a 1890s were an intense period of racial violence. There's an epidemic of lynching. State legislatures were rolling back Reconstruction, so they were disfranchising Black men and basically, you know, ignoring the 15th Amendment in that regard. They're instituting Jim Crow legislation. They're legalizing segregation during the same period. They're basically setting up a system of second-class citizenship. And so, and it's part of a culture of white supremacy in that period. And so what I say, you know, is that what men were doing in the seats of power across the South, women were supporting that culturally, whether it was through the monuments or through history or through educating children. They were very much on that team, you know, of promoting and sustaining white supremacy.
These monuments might be on the surface, Robert E. Lee or Nathan Bedford Forrest, but there was more to it than just the three-dimensional appearance in a town square, right?
Right. But see, because the thing about monuments, as I say in the book, it wasn't like the groups put them up and then walked away. It's not that, you know, that wouldn't have been enough. These statues are ritualized, not only at the unveiling, but they are ritualized on an annual basis through Confederate Memorial Day, when there are more speeches are being given and reaffirming the values, Confederate values, which is about states' rights, but also about white supremacy. And so they're doing that, but also UDC members who are, organized group called the Children of the Confederacy, which is their auxiliary, take these children down and teach lessons using the monument as part of the lesson. So and then also on the grounds of these courthouses, you know, in addition to the Confederate monument, this is also a place where lynchings often occur on the courthouse grounds. All of this is together. I found a case in North Carolina, in Morganton, where in 1927, where an African-American man was thought to have done something to a white girl. They chased him through. This was in the mountains here. They chased him. They found him. They shot and killed him, basically lynched him. That's a way of lynching. And they brought the body back to the county and laid it on the steps of the Confederate monument. You couldn't make a clearer connection than to do what they did. And 5,000 white people from the community came to look at that spectacle. These monuments can get used in a number of ways. That's obviously an extreme example of that, but it's, you know, the constant ritualizing of the monuments, even during the 50s, during the civil rights movement, there'll be, then the speeches become about communism. We've got to prevent against communism, but communism is just, you know, part of the code for stopping civil rights.
You mentioned, I'm speaking with Karen Cox. She is the author of the new book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. You mentioned that the monuments can be used in many different ways. And one was education, the idea that this lost cause, this idea of the Southern ideology connected to the founding fathers be passed on to generations. They would have children, white children, form living battle flags at these memorials. There's a picture of a teacher talking to young children in the 50s right underneath a Robert E. Lee statue. This was used to perpetuate this myth for generations.
It certainly was. Children are always involved in these rituals, and they continue. It becomes actually even more important in the 1950s to educate white children about these values of states' rights and this fear of federal intervention in what's going on in the South in the 50s and the 60s. And so the Lost Cause is in the textbooks and in the students read, and it remains in the textbooks really through the 70s, easily through the 1970s in some places. And we've even in more recent years, when the League of the South was formed in the 1990s, they held summer schools for white children to learn what they believe was the proper history and literature of the South.
Growing up in North Central Arkansas, and to this day, when I go drive back to where I grew up, I would often see yards that would have a Confederate flag and the United States flag together. And for years, I thought, well, this makes no sense. Don't they understand? Those were enemies for 4 years. But you explain in No Common Ground that almost since post-Reconstruction, you would see these two flags together because the thought was it was the Southerners who had stayed true to the Constitution and to the Founding Fathers. So they thought it was a great symbol to put the two flags together.
They did. They saw that, first of all, they felt like they were the true inheritors of the values of the Revolutionary War generation. And so they believed that the Confederate soldiers had gone to war to defend the Constitution of the United States, but they were very specific about that. It was the 10th Amendment, which was about states' rights. So that's what they went there for. But they always felt like they bristled at the idea of being called traitors, which they were. And so during all these unveiling ceremonies, both the American flag and the Confederate battle flag would be on display, but they would also sing songs, patriotic American songs, but also Dixie, the patriotic Southern song, I suppose you would say.
At first, when this first wave in the late 19th century is happening, there are newspaper columns from the North that deride this, but over time, Northern whites begin to become either ignore what's developing or kind of begin to embrace it. Why is that?
In the 19th century, you begin to see almost, I think one of the earliest reunions of veterans begins to take place in the early 1880s. So you're only about 15 years removed from the Civil War. So there's this feeling of wanting to, that they're Americans again, at least on the part of, this part of that reconciliation is like thinking of themselves as Americans. Of course, the Southerners are not about to give up the idea that they had, that their cause was a just cause. But I do believe that, it eventually just boils down to the simple fact that the white North wanted an economic relationship with the white South, that they, that this was about capitalism at the end of the day. And I think they wanted, to put these things aside I wrote in there, one of the things, there was a speech given at an unveiling, and this, they were talking, at how right the South was. And then when it gets printed in the paper in the North, they take out all that stuff and only talk about we'll be together again, as Americans kind of thing. But that only happens, at least for white Southerners, if it's acknowledged that they were only fighting, that they were really patriots in their effort to defend the Constitution.
There are some famous names from history who speak out against these monuments being erected, Frederick Douglass, W.E. Du Bois. But there are also some names that many of us don't know, journalists in Chicago and newspaper, Black and African-American newspaper men who are writing. This was not happening without a complete understanding from the minority population about what was being done.
Right. So this is true. So, you know, I like to remind people that white people are not the, you know, white people aren't the only Southerners in this region. Black people are Southerners too. They've lived here and raised their families here generation after generation. So what you see is the critique of Confederate monuments has been around since the 19th century, whether it was Black journalists like John Mitchell in Richmond, who published the Richmond Planet, or, you know, the Chicago Defender, which was really a national Black newspaper that circulated in the South and offered Black Southerners an opportunity to comment on these symbols in their community. And so this has been going on for as long as monuments have been up, that you know, Black Southerners recognize and understand what these monuments mean, what it means to them as citizens, or in this case, that has made them second-class citizens, that this whole lost cause narrative and this Confederate memorialization, they recognize what's happening there. And so, and that's, you know, in their view of history, unlike white Southerners subscribe to the lost cause. And so in that interpretation of history, the war wasn't about slavery. But if you're a Black Southerner, you know that the war, exactly what it was about. I mean, they, you know, white Southerners kind of play this game, you know, they're in this of historical amnesia about what the leaders of the Confederacy said the war was about. They ignore all of that. They focus on, you know, the romantic chivalrous soldier, someone like epitomized by Robert E. Lee, this Christian soldier, and who's you can't sully his name with talk of slavery, for example. But Black Southerners say, you know, no, you all were traitors to the nation. You are not patriots. Putting up these monuments is an insult to the names of Lincoln and Grant. And, you know, if we had our choice in the matter, we'd take these monuments out and grind them down into dust. I mean, that, you know, this is in the 30s. So for people who may think that this campaign to remove monuments or this critique of monuments is a very recent phenomenon and only since Black Lives Matter, really miss out on a longer history, a much longer history where this is ongoing and has been. What's been different is that, for all that time, people didn't pay attention to what Black Southerners had to say about these things. They ignored them. What's happened in more recent times, of course, is that they're being joined by white Southerners, younger Southerners, you know, people, a more plurality of people who live in the South.
Aaron Cox is author of No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. She's a professor of history at the University of North Carolina. She talked with us this spring via Zoom.
Topics that have been discussed so far in the KUAF podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, are the successes and obstacles of past integrated anti-racist movements, the progress that can be made through working class solidarity and diverse voting coalitions. And now we're discussing the immense wealth gap between white and Black Americans.
The amount of resources that would be required to bring Black businesses in even the striking distance of the scale and sustainability of white-owned enterprises is perhaps too staggering to conceive.
Episode 4 of The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, is available now at KUAF.com and anywhere you get your podcasts.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, according to new research, families worried about having enough food during the COVID-19 pandemic are 3 times more likely to experience anxiety or depression than those who have lost jobs. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports on research into the matter. Plus, highlights from Governor Asa Hutchinson's press briefing today about COVID-19 and how Holiday Island's mayor is handling his term as the community experiences a move from unincorporated to city second class. Those stories and more on a Wednesday, Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on KUAF 91.3. And on your time schedule, if you subscribe to our free podcast by going to KUAF.com or any of the major podcast distributors. And this weekend on the TED Radio Hour on KUAF, breathing is essential to life. And on our best days, we don't think much about the air we take in and breathe out. But now, from COVID to wildfires to Black Lives Matter, the air we breathe is often in the headlines and on our minds. And as our thinking about breath changes, so does our understanding of its power. Exploring ideas about air, breathing, and breath on the TED Radio Hour from NPR, Sunday afternoon beginning at 1 on 91.3 KUAF, your public radio station for more than 35 years.
My name is Rebecca Cavanaugh, calling from Springdale, Arkansas, and my earliest memories of listening to KUAF is when I was a little kid growing up in Southwest Missouri, and every year my parents would call and make a sponsoring donation in my name for my birthday, and it was always a big deal when they would come pick me up from daycare that they would turn it on and just in time for me to hear them say my name, and it would just make my day. Thank you so much to Public Radio, and I'm really happy that I get to continue donating now that I'm all grown up. Thanks. Bye.
We're hearing from so many in the KUAF listening area about how NPR has affected them in the past 50 years. What's your favorite memory of KUAF Public Radio? Call the KUAF Connects line at 479-575-6577 and let us know. You could hear yourself on the radio. That's 575-6577. 575-6577. The KUAF Connects line.
This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Siloam Springs. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Contributors included Jacqueline Froelich, Lee Wood, and Leah Uribe. Our theme is written by Daryl Sean. It's titled First Hurrah. This reminder, no 7 o'clock edition of Ozarks at Large tonight will make way for the live concert from Walton Arts Center with the Dover Quartet, hosted by Lee Wood and Leah Uribe. Our militant grammarian Catherine Sherrills and John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, not with us this Tuesday as usual. We do expect to have them back with us next Tuesday. Don't forget, you can find out all about us and listen to past shows, interviews, and stories by going to OzarksAtLarge.com. And if you go to KUAF.com, you can sign up for the absolutely free KUAF Ozarks at Large daily email newsletter. We send it to you every weekday afternoon. It's free. It will list what was on the show that day, plus other items, and provide direct links to the stories, interviews, and pieces that we had on that day's show. Then you can share them with friends and neighbors through social media and email. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for making us part of your day. We do sincerely appreciate it. Please take care of yourself. We'll talk again soon.